This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to start our show by talking about climate change and the effect on a certain part of the world. And I've got Ashley Thornburg in studio with me here in Fargo because we have Amy Martin. She is the person behind the Threshold podcast, which is funded by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, in which we have been playing elements of the Threshold podcast on Prairie Public's radio network Sunday at 5 Central. The conclusion, as a matter of fact, of the Arctic series is this Sunday at 5 Central. So, Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thank you for broadcasting the series. That means a lot to us.
This season is called Cold Comfort. It is, as Doug mentioned, based in the Arctic. You spent a summer traveling to all of the countries that are in the Arctic. Why did you want to set season two in the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic is a fascinating place, and I think that maybe a lot of people, including myself, until I did this reporting, might not realize what an important place it is. It is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet right now due to climate change, and that is important to the people and the animals that live there, but it actually has huge consequences for all the rest of us because of all the effects it has on the overall planetary climate system.
How aware are the people who live in that part of the world about the challenges facing them?
Very, very, very aware. You know, climate change is not a question in the Arctic. It is a lived experience that people have been dealing with, you know, in many places for decades already. And, you know, people, you can't not be aware when the permafrost is thawing underneath your house or your school every year and you have to rebuild, or when you can't hunt the way you've always hunted because the sea ice is gone. It's just very obvious. It's affecting pretty much all aspects of life for most people.
How does that compare, would you say, with your experience? How aware is the rest of the world with what's happening, for example, where the season two starts out in Shishmaref, Alaska?
Yeah, you know, there's a real disconnect, I think, for those of us who don't live in the Arctic with what's going on up there. I think for a lot of us, it feels so far away. You know, a lot of people might not even be aware that there are hardly any people who live there when there are actually 4 million people who live in the Arctic. And I think that's an ongoing frustration for people who live in the Arctic. And there's actually an analog in my mind between people who live in rural places, you know, like North Dakota or parts of Montana where I live, or even parts of Iowa where I grew up, where you kind of feel like your story is often not reflected in the mainstream media. I think it feels that way to a lot of people in the Arctic, of like, why isn't anyone paying attention to what's going on up here?
So there's a feeling among the people you were visiting with that the rest of the world doesn't much care about what happens?
Well, you know, I think there is an increasing concern about the Arctic, but I think, unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is if the Arctic makes the headlines at all, the focus is on ice or on polar bears. And those things are very, very important. And they're, you know, polar bears are part of a lot of Arctic cultures. But we really felt like what was lacking was hearing the stories of the Arctic from the people who live there themselves. And so that's what we tried to focus on is, you know, it's not like we got into the science. We went on a scientific expedition to the Greenland ice sheet, and the science is super important. We did talk some about wildlife issues, but we really tried to center the whole series around, but what does it feel like to live here, you know, in Greenland, in Russia, in Norway, in Alaska, and be watching these things happen, you know, right out your front door?
Just the logistics of this, like you said, 4 million people across 8 countries. You were able to spend several weeks, the whole summer, really, in the Arctic. How did you find who you wanted to talk to, and did that change along the way?
Yeah, and just to clarify, we actually spent an entire summer, and then we went, you know, my producer Nick Motz went in the winter to Canada, and then I made an additional month-long trip later in the spring. So we had, it was all told about 18 months of research and reporting in the Arctic. And you know, in terms of how we found who we wanted to talk to, a fair amount of internet research and Googling and reading articles and following up with people, But then once you get there, it's just like any kind of interesting story where you talk to someone and they say, oh, well, now that I know you and I maybe trust you a little bit and I have a sense of what you're interested in, you really should talk to so-and-so. And then that person sends you to the person they think of. And so there was a whole lot of, you know, connecting with people and getting it networked into their communities.
Well, you're... series is very evocative. Your use of sound and your personal experience is well transmitted to the listener. And I was thinking about the very first piece in this podcast where you encounter this wall of ice that's thousands of feet high. Can you relate to our listeners what the most memorable experience you had in creating this series, the thing that really sticks out in your mind?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's tough because there are so many, but I will say that the Greenland ice sheet just remains incredibly fascinating to me. You know, it's like I love to hike. I love to camp. I love to get out into nature and do stuff. And I kind of thought I knew like what our planet was made of, you know, and then you go to the Greenland ice sheet and it's like encountering this thing that is so important to the whole planet and yet feels almost alien, because it's a block of ice that's as big as the state of Alaska and it's 10,000 feet thick in the middle, and it just boggles the mind. And then also the fact that it's so old, you know, like the very earliest humans to ever try to cross into the Americas ran into ice sheets like that. And so it's just kind of on every level, the scale of age and size and everything, it's just, it really kind of just scrambled my brain in a way that was honestly totally delightful. Just like the way the first time you see a big mountain and you're kind of like, how can this be, you know? But but also I would say many of the interactions, the human interactions, the relationships I developed remain really close to my heart and feel, you know, transformative. I feel like I learned so much from people in every place I visited.
The Greenland ice sheet is melting.
Yes, it is.
And that is significant because that's not sea ice.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. There's, you know, sea ice is also melting and thinning. The cover is getting smaller year by year. You know, the trend is towards smaller. But that doesn't raise sea levels. The Greenland ice sheet, you know, I like to think of it. I do presentations in schools sometimes. And it's like if you're standing there in the cafeteria holding a glass of water and it's almost full, and then your friend comes along with a handful of ice cubes and dumps it in your glass of water, it's going to spill, the cup's going to spill over. That's what the Greenland ice sheet is this giant ice cube that we're melting and putting into that cup of water, which is called the oceans of the world. And so that is going to raise sea level. It is raising sea level. And the real crucial question to figure out is how fast is that going to happen? And that comes down to understanding how the ice sheet moves as it warms. And there are scientists from around the world scrambling to try to figure this out because, you know, if we have a certain amount of sea level rise that happens over the course of 50 years versus 500, that is a very different sort of societal problem that we have to grapple with. And we need to know what we're dealing with.
And as we think about societal problems and rising sea levels, of course, water being the earliest form of mass transportation anyway, so many of the major population centers on this planet are on waterways.
Exactly. Exactly. We, you know, humans like to live on coastlines for all kinds of good reasons. The climate is often nice. There's, you know, access to transport, like you said. And it's just, you know, that's where we like to congregate. And obviously, all of us don't. I live in a landlocked state, as do you. But, you know, the bulk of the population of the world or large chunks of it lives along coastlines. And so I think that's what, you know, people really need to understand is when we're talking about these kind of abstract concepts about ice melt in the Arctic, what we're really talking about is potential huge refugee crises, not in some faraway country that maybe we haven't heard of before, but right here in the United States and in Europe and lots of countries around the world, where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people may need to move in short order. And that's just a recipe for social chaos and all kinds of, you know, deprivations, hunger and disease. And so when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about human suffering or the avoidance of human suffering. That's why we need to be doing the science up there so we can protect ourselves and prepare for outcomes in a way that's smart and gives us a better chance of success.
Amy Martin is the creator of Threshold, a podcast and public radio show, and you can hear the podcast at thresholdpodcast.org. Find out more about Amy at amymartin.org. Amy, this is funded in part by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, so obviously you're dealing with crisis issues on Threshold.
Yeah. And you know, and I think partly what's tricky about the crises in the Arctic is that, you know, sometimes crises happen over the course of decades and not over the course of months or weeks. And, you know, it's important to pay attention to the hurricanes and the floods, like the floods that are happening now in the Midwest. It's also important to pay attention to these. They might seem like longer term crises that take decades to play out. But in the course of the Earth's time scale, that's, you know, that's a heartbeat. That's such a fast time for some of these changes to be happening. So, yeah, these are crises in terms of the cultural change and disruption and the climate change and disruption that's happening up there.
Does your work involve law or policymakers at all?
You know, we actually are probably going to get into that a little bit more in an upcoming. We're doing an upcoming special about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Because that is such a policy and lawmaker centric issue. But in general, certainly would never avoid talking to politicians, lawmakers, policy analysts. But I feel like I'm really drawn towards talking to people that are on the ground, living their ordinary lives, dealing with things more at the grassroots level. Mainly because I feel like they're often not consulted enough. You know, we hear from a few very loud, powerful voices over and over and over, and we don't hear as much, you know, from the vice mayor of Shishmaref, Alaska, population 600, who is just as smart and just as important in understanding some of these issues, but, you know, harder to get to and maybe isn't given as loud of a, or as big of a platform.
Is Threshold going to move to other climate areas, though, like deserts, rainforests, islands, which are also threatened by this?
Well, you know, in the long term, yes. But the premise of our show is that we take one big environmental issue and we dig into it over a number of episodes, you know, series by series. So first series, as you know, was about the American bison. This one was about the Arctic. We don't know yet what season three is going to be about. But it could be, you know, anything from energy issues to, you know, any kind of environmental issue that you can think of. But certainly, I don't think you can really talk about any kind of environmental question right now and not have climate change come up because it's affecting everything.
Let's talk a bit about the podcast itself. How did Threshold come to be?
Threshold came to be because I wanted to tell these kinds of stories. I wanted to dig deeper. I was doing some freelance radio news for NPR and for our local station here, Montana Public Radio, which is also a key partner in producing Threshold. And I like doing radio news, and it's important. But I also was feeling kind of confined by, you know, the fact that a 5-minute story in radio news is long. There's just so much that you, especially with environmental stories where there's often some learning that needs to happen to get our minds around, you know, what's going on in a particular place, what some of the language is that we need to understand to be able to wrap our heads around different issues. So I wanted to tell more stories, deeper stories. I wanted to give people on all sides of complex issues a chance to be heard and not reduce people down to kind of simplistic stereotypes, you know, the pro person, the anti person, and call it good. I really wanted to get to know the people behind those opinions and give listeners a chance to open their minds to perspectives that maybe they wouldn't if it was in a super short format. And instead kind of like taking in a person, like you're a whole person. Maybe I like you, even if I disagree with your perspectives, but that can maybe help take the tone of anger down around some of these issues and help us hear each other is my hope.
Sounds like a very expensive podcast to produce.
You are so right about that.
Talk about the partnerships that you have with the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. You mentioned Montana Public Radio. I think there is a connection with the University of Montana at Missoula as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through Montana Public Radio. Yeah, it is. It's in some ways it's a completely stupid way to go about making a podcast because it's incredibly expensive and time consuming, you know, because you can just like turn on a microphone and sit in your basement and talk to somebody and call it a podcast. But I don't really want to listen to those kinds of podcasts. I want to be pushed to learn and to grow. And so that's the kind of show I wanted to make. And we've been really lucky to, for season two, the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting made a big investment in us, and so did the Park Foundation, Montana Public Radio. We also have an incredible network of listeners who are donors, and we could not be making the show without them. And, you know, it's like so many other kind of public radio projects where you just have to hustle, hustle, hustle to convince people that the work you're doing is worthy of them, you know, making an investment in it. And so far that has happened. And I do not take 1 cent of that for granted. And I just hope that we can continue to find the support we need to do this kind of storytelling.
Well, radio is about 100 years old as a communication technology. The podcast is growing in interest, I think. Lots of people are starting to stream online content, and it's exciting that this particular program is in both mediums, if you will. Amy Martin is the creator of the Threshold podcast. You can hear the conclusion of her Arctic series, 5 o'clock on Sunday on the Prairie Public Radio Network. That's Central Time. And read and find out more at thresholdpodcast.org. Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving your listeners a chance to hear Threshold.
Coming up on Main Street, Matt Olien reviews Gloria Bell.
Next time on The Pulse.
So I'm mixing up my marinade.
How we eat is personal.
Beans. Or in Spanish, like frijoles de la olla. Does something to me. You know, it just grounds me.
Foods that make us feel good and healthy.
I felt fan-freaking-tastic.
We'll explore our personal relationships with food.
Catch The Pulse tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Well, that fanfare says it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien, and this week it's Gloria Bell.
Yeah, Julianne Moore, who's a wonderful actress, Oscar winner. This is a remake by director Sebastian Lelio from Chile, and it's a remake of his film called Gloria, which came out in 2013. Now, most recently, he's known for the film A Fantastic Woman, which won the foreign language Oscar a year ago, which is a wonderful picture. So this is a remake. Original was set in Santiago, Chile. Now we're set in modern-day Los Angeles. She is a divorcee with 2 kids, and she likes to go to bars and just dance. I don't know a lot of people that do that, but I'm sure there are some out there.
Does she get to hear her song, Gloria?
Well, you have to go to the film
Okay. Just
to understand that. But she often – some of the best scenes in this film are when she sings to herself in the car. She's driving, and we've all done that. Well, I've done that.
I
shouldn't say all people have done it. So what Lelio really captures here is kind of the mundane aspects of life. She's folding laundry in a scene and singing Paul McCartney's No More Lonely Nights. She's driving in the car singing an Olivia Newton-John song. She goes to these nightclubs just to dance and sometimes meet people, sometimes men or men that she's known since her divorce. She meets John Turturro, who's also divorced, and that he is the other lead in the film. And they meet one night and begin dating. And where it goes from there, you're going to have to wait and see and watch the film. What's interesting about it is not a lot happens in this movie. I think it's a film that the critics have liked more than mainstream audiences, because I think I've talked to a couple of people already who say, well, nothing happened. But that's life. Lelio captures this, I think, pretty well. There were moments I was wishing for a little bit more from the film, but Julianne Moore carries it off. She's so good in this part. She's flawed. She's complicated. She makes mistakes. She's a good mom to her grown kids. Turturro is good, too. You know, he gives a portrayal of kind of this middle-aged guy who's got a lot of hang-ups. And is he a good fit with Gloria? You know, these the thing about dating in the 50s, they're both in their 50s, divorced, people bring a lot of baggage to relationships. They both got grown kids. Turturro's kids are very dependent on him. That's a side plot that's quite interesting, where he can't quite pull away from that dependency that his kids still have on him. So everyone brings baggage to that relationship. How they negotiate that baggage with each other, are they a good fit with each other, are they not, is quite interesting. But Turturro plays a character we don't often see on screen, kind of that middle-aged man who's uptight. He's got his regimented life, doesn't like change very much, very attached to his family, too attached to his ex-wife still, which comes into the plot as well. And he performs it really well. He just looks like a guy who can't relax. He's too uptight, even though he really likes Gloria. So I liked all that aspects of the film. It's a short film, only about 1 hour and 40 minutes long. Not a great film. I do think maybe the Chilean version is better, and I've seen both, because I think Gloria in the 2013 film, her dancing at nightclubs in Santiago, has a little bit more verve. I like that. I like that vibe a little bit more than Julianne Moore going to nightclubs in L.A. But she's so good in this film. If this would have been released late last year, she might have slipped into that Best Actress mix. Who knows? But whatever she does, she's great in.
It does seem to me, though, that – and tell me, has the movie world changed? We've got lots of women now in films that are very interesting, I think, generally, but more women leading roles. Us, last week, we talked about that.
Yeah, this is definitely a change that I have seen in the last 5 to 10 years, Doug, for the better. Not only more women directors, even though Lelio is a male director, but what we're seeing is there's a market for a Julianne Moore film about a divorcee going to dance at nightclubs.
In her 50s.
There's a market. The theater was full. Lots of people there. Remember the Sally Field film a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Hello, My Name is Doris. Made lots of money. So there is, with the right actress, big name, and a big enough name to get people in the theater, Streep, Sally Field, Julianne Moore, Maggie Smith, Judi Dench. There's a market for that, and I think that's being recognized more lately, that we're seeing the Julianne Moore, Annette Bening type star-driven film, even though those actresses are both pushing 60 now. That is a change, and I don't know if that's a result of Me Too, which is very recent. I think it's more a result of Hollywood recognizing there's a market for that.
Yeah.
And people like Julianne Moore, Jessica Chastain being very outspoken about, yes, there need to be more roles for aging actresses.
Let's ask another question that's sort of related to this. I'm seeing more films that are actually originate in another country.
Yeah, that's not new. That is an old Hollywood trick to basically take a film, a foreign language film that's done very well, and make it Americanized. Jack Nicholson was attached to a remake of the Tony Erdmann film from Germany, but he's pulled out of that film. I don't know if that's for health reasons or what, but this is very, very, very typical, where Hollywood will take that, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, for example.
Yeah.
And you know, the Swedish version, I think, is much better than the Daniel Craig Rooney Mara version. That's another example, and another topic for another day, of the lack of originality. Look, we've got Disney remakes with CGI characters, Dumbo, Aladdin, and The Lion King. What's the difference with humans in there? There's not a lot of difference. That's a lack of originality, and it drives me nuts.
Well, when I've seen the trailers for Dumbo, I'm thinking this is different Dumbo than I remember.
My daughter doesn't even want to see it, but yes.
You mentioned Julianne Moore won an Oscar for
Still Alice, 2014.
Okay, so here's our real Oscar trivia question this week. The first non-Hollywood film to win an Academy Award of any sort, any Academy Award.
Well, Hamlet was the first.
You're in the neighborhood.
Non-American film to win Best Picture in 48, but
yeah,
that's not what you're looking for.
This is 1932-33. And it was Best Actor Award, is what?
Charles Laughton in Private Life of Henry VIII, the British film.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Coming up on Main Street, Mark Trahant offers a commentary on attempts to repeal the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. Sue Malcolm joins us for Main Street Eats. And Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening list of things to do. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The House has passed a series of measures designed to shore up the public employees' retirement system. The system is still recovering from the economic downturn of 2008. One bill would reduce the multiplier for employees hired after December 31st from 2 to 1.75. Another bill would end the health credit, instead keeping that money in the main retirement plan. And a third would increase the employer contributions to the retirement plan by 1% per year. But the House Appropriations Committee added a study to that measure to look at changing from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. Fargo Democratic Representative Pamela Anderson argued against the study. She says the issue has been studied a lot in the past.
What will another study do? I submit to you it will do nothing but unnecessarily spend money and further delay a solution to the PERS funding crisis.
But House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jeff Delzer of Underwood argued the study is necessary.
At some point, if we ever want to get away from unfunded liability, we have to go to defined contribution. That's mostly what the study's about, is figuring out how to do it.
Delzer says the study would also look at switching the university system from the current PERS plan to the TIAA CREF plan, which is defined contribution plan. The amendment with the study passed 69-22. The amended bill was approved 76-15. The measure will now go back to the Senate to see if that body agrees with the changes. And the weed killer dicamba has damaged millions of acres of crops and is the focus of a class action lawsuit. But as Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports, that a major agricultural business is looking to expand its use.
Dicamba is primarily used on soybeans and cotton. The problem comes when the herbicide drifts onto other fields. Yet Bayer has asked the Environmental Protection Agency to allow it to be used on corn in about 5 years. Bob Hartzler is an Iowa State professor and weed specialist. He says he's skeptical.
It seems like if we cannot fix this problem within those 5 years, how the EPA would even consider any expansion in the use of dicamba would boggle my mind.
Bayer declined to be interviewed, but said in a statement that dicamba expansion would give farmers more flexibility in weed control and would add to crop safety. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk to Bismarck Democratic Senator Erin Olvan. She's a member of both the Education and Government and Veterans Affairs Committees, and we'll discuss the big issues that those committees tackled, including a change in governance for higher education. Legislative Review, Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central Time, here on Prairie Public.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years, but I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this Grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This is National Tribal Public Health Week, and today is American Indian Public Health Day, with observances at NDSU and UND. So it seems timely to offer a commentary from Mark Trahant, the editor of Indian Country Today. Mark comments about attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act and the Indian Health Care Improvement Act.
The Justice Department wrote a letter to the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals that said it would file a brief supporting a district court decision to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act. No matter how the appeals court rules, this matter is likely to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Striking down the Affordable Care Act would have an immediate impact on more than 20 million Americans who are covered by insurance through Medicaid expansion or insurance exchanges. The law also includes the Indian Health Care Improvement Act and it would be included in any rollback of the legislation. It's hard to understate the significance of a judicial repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid, for example, is now a significant source of funding for the Indian health system, especially for facilities managed by tribes and nonprofit organizations. More than one out of every four Native American patients in the Indian health system is covered by Medicaid. A study in 2017 by the Kaiser Family Foundation said Medicaid provisions in the Affordable Care Act led to an increase in coverage gains among American Indians and Alaska Natives and increased revenue to IHS and tribally operated facilities. In addition to the increased revenue, health systems have modeled procedures and funding based on the 2010 law. If it were struck down, there would be nothing to replace the revenue or the health care procedures until Congress enacted a new one. That would mean a law that is as acceptable to the Republicans in the Senate, the Democrats in the House, and President Trump. An impossible hurdle. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Native American issues online at IndianCountryToday.com. Main Street Eats is next.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson about smallpox.
Smallpox was still a very serious international epidemic in the time of Jefferson. Some of his own slaves were carried off into British ships where they died of the smallpox. Jefferson became a champion of first inoculation and then the much more efficient vaccination.
Both he and John Adams went through inoculation, which was no pleasant event.
Jefferson became an enthusiast for the vaccine, and he wrote Edward Jenner, the person who devised the true vaccine, what can only be called a fan letter, in which Jefferson said, "You have erased from the calendar of human afflictions one of the greatest."
Jefferson sent smallpox vaccine with Lewis and Clark, but it did not survive the journey.
Unfortunately, the vaccine was inert by the time Lewis and Clark got to population centers, but Jefferson wanted to prevent the spread of the disease amongst Native Americans.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio. And in Bismarck, we have Sue Belcom of the Rootsellers Farm near Mandan, and she is our regular on Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
There is still some snow on the ground, but we are thinking spring and getting ready to get our hands in the dirt and start harvesting some early spring crops, or maybe go to the grocery store and get some already. And asparagus is a good thing to look for this time of year.
Absolutely. You'll find it on many store shelves. It's traditionally served with your ham at Easter time. In fact, I remember the first time I ever had served asparagus. I read a lot of Women's Day and Family Circle magazines when I was young, which is why I have this like wealth of useless information in my head. But we prepared asparagus for Easter dinner, and it was kind of cute because my dad picked the tops of them off, you know, the best part, picked that top of the asparagus off and ate the stems. And I'm like, well.
And didn't eat the best part?
I know, right? I was just like, no, you got to eat the whole thing. But he had never seen them before. And yet we grew up with. That's gospel truth, man. And you know what? I realized years later when I started looking into growing asparagus that we had a patch of asparagus in our backyard because we used to play with those feathery, whippy things with the little red berries on. Now, had we been smart and gone out this time of year or, well, okay, this was an exceptional snow year for us, but it's time to start playing Yule Gibbons and getting out there and looking for asparagus because it does come up this early in the spring when the weather conditions are right. But here I'm thinking all those years we could have been eating asparagus and we didn't because we didn't recognize it.
Well, my mother was a home ec graduate and I think she was. They had a class where they said, here's how to fool your kids about stuff they won't ordinarily eat. And so we had cheese asparagus on toast a lot, and it was a favorite at our place.
So did she cut it up into, like, little pieces? It wasn't, like, long stems. It was, like, cut up and served in a sauce?
This was when the only place you found asparagus was inside a can.
Ooh, and that's the worst stuff in the world.
You put enough cheese on it, and it's delicious. You can't get enough of it if you're 8 years old.
Oh, Velveeta, no doubt.
Well, it was a processed cheese, I'm sure of that.
Well, if you're going to look for asparagus, skip the canned goods aisle and go straight to your fresh produce department and look for some thin spears. They're more intense in flavor and they're less watery than the fat ones, although I've never met an asparagus that I didn't just totally love.
I know. I love them. I'm partial to the oven roasted myself.
Oh, yes. And then I make a lemon butter where you take and melt a quarter cup or a half a cup of butter, and then you whisk in fresh lemon juice and it kind of gets thick and creamy. Oh, my gosh. That's like just... Yes. And it's so much fun to eat them because you can pick them up and play with them first because, you know, they're long. They're a long vegetable.
Sword fighting.
Yeah. Sword fight. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And because I like stuff that lasts a long time on the shelf, you know, like the stuff you got in the cans, you can also get the pickled asparagus.
Oh, yes. I love that, too. That's really awesome. But if you're buying it fresh, you want to eat it as soon as you can when you bring it home from the store. And really the best, I find that I like it raw. And the best thing you've ever eaten is if you can find it outdoors. We do have a patch at our house that was kind of wild there, you know, just growing. I think it spreads with the wind, you know, and it grows. It's kind of hard to grow. You got to I heard one time you got to have an east-west wind going across it one way and a north-south wind going across the other way and all that kind of good stuff. But, boy, when it's crispy and snappy and fresh out of the ground, that is, like, totally awesome.
Now, there's white asparagus, too, isn't there?
Yes, and in order to do that, I believe you have to do what you do with celery. And is it arugula? There's another lettuce variety that you have to cover to keep it out of the sun, and then it doesn't do the photosynthesis thing and turn green.
So it's sort of a vampire asparagus.
Yeah, it grows in the dark. But you want that beautiful green color on those plates with that wonderful ham and all that good stuff. Unless you're grilling steaks, in which you can certainly grill asparagus also.
Yes, I have had that. That's great.
Well, an asparagus, though, does have one of those unfortunate side effects occasionally similar to beets, maybe, where it's possible. I've called the nurse line and said, hey, what happened?
Forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
If you need to leave a urine sample, maybe don't eat a lot of asparagus.
Oh, my gosh. That is the word that was used in the article I just recently read called it a haunting smell.
That is a delicate way of putting it.
No, it should be a Halloween food.
But it's
not. Move over Easter.
They named it, you know. It's called post-asparagus stinky urine disorder.
You made that up.
No. Honest to gosh. I just found it. It's PASID if you just look at the acronym. And, you know, it's not everybody. Not everybody has this issue, but it has something to do with how well you can digest it. And I think that the French, almost 100% of their population have this disorder, while only half of the Brits do. And so, depending on your nationality, you may not ever have that haunting smell after you eat asparagus. But it's a healthy thing because it apparently flushes toxins along with it.
That's an interesting verb you just used, yeah.
Oh, and you can grow it yourself, you know. I will post some information on my website about how to take care of it. But it's best if you plant it to go ahead and divide somebody else's plants and plant the stalk instead of the seed. And it takes a long time to get established.
Yeah, a couple years, right?
Yep, and you do not want to pick all of it because you need some of it to grow up so that it kind of reproduces. But, hey, get this, Ashley. Unlike human beings, the male plants are way more productive because they don't have to spend any time growing those pretty little red berries. So if you want to get an all-male patch of asparagus, you can check out the rootsellers.com, and I'll give you some more information on where to buy some plants and how to grow your own patch.
And when you harvest it, you're just cutting off what's above the ground? Is that what you do?
Yep, you kind of snap it off. And there's two schools of thought when it comes to the stuff you purchase. If you look at the way bottom, you know, it kind of is white yet mm-hmm. from being under the soil. And they always say that you should snap it, and where it breaks, you throw the bottom half in your soup stock freezer bag and cook the top half. But then you're kind of wasting some of that good flavor. So if you want to just line them up and cut the ends off with a knife before you serve them, that's perfectly okay too.
Okay.
Sue, are you familiar with any studies going back to the stinky urine disorder? And is it possible it's related to if you eat only male asparagus?
That's a good question. I'll bet you could write a grant to figure that out someday. You know, you could do some research in that, and then we'd have to, of course, segregate your asparagus at the grocery store. You'd have the female plant on one side and the male plant on the other side.
Well, we've been digging in the dirt with asparagus with Sue Belcom. It's always fun to chat with you, Sue.
Thank you, Sue.
Oh, thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. The 2018-2019 season, Time Travel, concludes with Time in a Bottle, 7:30 p.m. Saturday, April 13th at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium, featuring the winners of our 2018 Young Artist Competition and the works of John Sibelius. Tickets are available online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Yeah, that's the question we ask every Thursday. Ashley Thornburg and I look at our calendar of things to do for the weekend, and, you know, we've got a fair amount of interesting things to look at this week.
Like ForksCon. This is coming back here Saturday the 6th in East Grand Forks at the Eagles Club. This is a celebration of comics and popular culture, whether that's in print, film, TV, games, toys, other kinds of art. ForksCon will be packed with vendors selling memorabilia, toys, comics. All of this will be available. And this comes to you thanks to ValleyCon and the Red River Science Fiction and Fantasy Organization. ForksCon, again, is in East Grand Forks at the Eagles Club this Saturday, April 6th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Tickets are just $5.
The Dakota Film Festival is in Bismarck at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium starting this evening and running through Saturday. The event kicks off at 7 o'clock tonight with a full-length documentary, The Great Alone, presented by Bismarck State College and Arts Quest. Friday's Night of Shorts starts at 7 o'clock as well and features award-winning short films from the region and around the world. Filmmakers will be invited on stage to talk about what their work, and there will be a Saturday matinee at 2 o'clock with additional films as well as the Dakota Film Dash competition and awards ceremony. So there you go. The movies are being shown at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck. It starts this evening. The cost is $52 for an all-access pass, and I suspect there are other ways to get into this festival as well.
There's a Pysanky Egg Workshop this Saturday the 6th at the Ukrainian Cultural Institute. This is those really beautiful Easter eggs that you see often in Ukrainian style here. So you can learn about this decorating class. This is a must for anyone who is interested in this timeless art. It goes from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday the 6th in Dickinson at the Ukrainian Cultural Institute. Class registration fee includes all of the materials that you need to make two different eggs. This is $15 on Saturday the 6th.
Here's a fundraiser called Wine and Wishes. It's Friday in Fargo at the Hilton Garden Inn. You can enjoy a signature fundraising event for Make-A-Wish North Dakota. The evening will include an inspirational connection to the mission of Make-A-Wish and highlight the lasting impact of those wishes that are granted. You can experience firsthand the power of a wish come true as Wish Kids share their wishes and the impact it had on them and their families. There will be wine pairings with hearty hors d'oeuvres, a silent auction with electronic bidding, and a live auction as well. This is a fundraiser again for Make-A-Wish North Dakota. It's 6 to 9:30 on Friday at the Hilton Garden Inn in Fargo. The cost is $50 for a ticket.
There is a maple syrup demonstration day this Saturday, the 6th, in Pelican Rapids, Minnesota at Maplewood State Park, as the Friends of Maplewood will be teaching guests the story of how maple syrup comes from the tree onto a pancake near you. And you get to learn how the Native American peoples here made maple sugar and tapped those trees, got that wonderful maple syrup, taught that to the early settlers of this area. 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event is free. Tickets to get into the park is $7, or unless you happen to have one of those Minnesota State Parks vehicle passes. The event, again, itself is free. 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday at Maplewood State Park.
And we'll have a guest talking about maple syrup making. That'll be next Tuesday on Main Street. Of course, at this latitude, those maple trees are getting ready to present syrup, so this is a great time for that. And Springtime Slime, not related at all, is Saturday in Minot at the Nature's Nook Children's Toys and Bookstore, because we simply do not have enough slime, said no parent ever. Each participant will have a chance to complete two Springtime Slime jars, one to keep and one to give away. All supplies will be provided. It's from 10 in the morning until 11, so it's 1 hour. It costs $10. Again, it's in Minot at Nature's Nook Children's Toys and Bookstore. I think the kids will have a lot of fun at Springtime Slime.
Well, springtime, you might find some slimy kinds of thing here with my pick of the week, and that is a spring cleanup at the Roosevelt Zoo this Saturday and Sunday, the 6th and 7th of April. Many hands make light work, you know that. And zoos, of course, are open to children and, well, to the young at heart, and sometimes they need a little bit of help getting some things cleaned up, and that is because it is almost nice enough to start going to the zoo on a regular basis. Of course, you can go sometimes to the zoo and you're all bundled up, but the summer season for the Roosevelt Zoo kicks off on the 27th, and they want to look their best, so you can get out there and do a little bit of cleaning up. 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. both days, Saturday and Sunday, the 6th and 7th in Minot at the Roosevelt Zoo.
My pick of the week is the FM Ballet presenting Tribute. This is Saturday and Sunday in Fargo at the Fargo Theater, Saturday evening from 7 to 9, and then Sunday afternoon matinee at 2 o'clock. This season's spring production, Tribute, is a mixed repertoire production celebrating 40 years of the Gasper family creating and teaching dance in the FM area. That's Eddie and Kathy Gasper and Matt Gasper, who now continues the tradition of having a school and presenting the FM Ballet in concerts as well. Eddie passed away a few years ago. Kathy will be here for this. And this includes something for everyone. It's jazz and tap pieces, a contemporary ballet, a classic ballet. It's a one-of-a-kind celebration. The Gasper family, again, presenting at the Fargo Theater, one of their favorite venues over the years. It's Saturday at 7 o'clock, Sunday at 2 o'clock. Tickets are $8 to $30, and that's what's happening.
There are many ways to listen to Prairie Public. We've got mobile apps, streaming via our handsome new website, prairiepublic.org, which just got a makeover. Through smart speakers like the Amazon Echo, just enable the skill and ask you know who to play NPR or Prairie Public. And are we forgetting something? Oh yeah, you can listen to Prairie Public across the state of North Dakota on a good old-fashioned radio. That's right, it's just like when you discover that the music you like listening to is now considered classic rock. Yeah, it kind of hurts. Radio, still kicking it after all these years.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 4th. On this date in 1910, Ferdinand Stahm was settling back into his home in Langdon. He had spent 3 months visiting family and friends in Germany, his first trip back to his childhood home since moving to North Dakota in 1905. He renewed his acquaintance with his mother and several brothers and sisters. He said it was a pleasure to view the scenes of his childhood. He had arrived on Christmas Eve and delighted in spending the holiday with family. Stahm did not return to North Dakota alone. Two of his friends from Germany joined him. They had heard so much of America and North Dakota that they decided to come along, planning to settle in Langdon. But what really caused a stir were the horses Stahm brought with him from Germany, 4 purebred Belgian mares and a stallion. The horses generated a great deal of interest, but Stahm made it very clear that none were for sale. They were intended for his stock farm near Loma. The real star was the 3-year-old stallion, a chestnut horse with a white mane and tail. It was quite an adventure for Stahm to bring his horses safe and sound to North Dakota. The ocean voyage took 16 days. Once he arrived in New York, Stahm transferred the horses to railroad cars. It took 9 days to travel from New York to Langdon. In 1910, farms were still run, in large part, with real horsepower. The powerful draft horses plowed the fields and pulled the threshing machines. They hauled huge wagons of hay to the barns for storage. They pulled wagons to town with goods to be sold and hauled supplies on the return trip. The gentle giants were the bedrock of agriculture. Draft horses are the largest equines, used for heavy work and bred for a gentle temperament. They weigh between 1,400 and 2,200 pounds. Although they are no longer used for routine agricultural work, draft horses are still much admired. There are many draft horse shows throughout North Dakota, and they are often seen pulling wagons in parades. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Daybook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, Texas lawmakers wrestle over the line between stopping voter fraud and hurting voter rights.
Nothing in this bill is going to criminalize people who inadvertently check the wrong box.
And WrestleMania gives female stars their moment.
It matters to go on last, and it's a real moment of validation.
Hear news and stories that expand your world on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
If you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question, it's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via Facebook, where we are Main Street at Prairie Public. And you can still call toll-free 888-755-6377.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hold our monthly Editor's Roundtable. Among the topics, developments at the legislature and spring flooding news. Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson will be joined by two special guests, Matt Von Pannon, editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and Steve Andrist, executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday and our Editor's Roundtable. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.